Well, here's a sentence I never expected to say. The On The Way podcast has gone to Florida. it's Dom Fay here, continuing the tour of the Northern Hemisphere for the podcast, sharing conversations with some of our favourite thinkers and writers about life, reality, and what any of this really means. And it is such a great joy today to be joined by a man who is an author, teacher, and someone whose work has helped so many of us in so many ways. After a number of conversations shared via Zoom in recent years, it is a great gift now to be sitting down face-to-face with Brian McLaren here in the town of Naples, Florida. Brian, thank you so much for welcoming me to your part of the world.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet you in person and not be talking around half the world.
Yes.
And,
yes.
And also, we're in a beautiful setting with the sun coming up and boats out in the bay. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, it is lovely. We're here in the hotel room I've got for the night with a view of the marina behind me. And I've just been saying to Brian, we went for dinner last night and then this morning I've been for a walk, and it's lovely to be able to walk around in a t-shirt again. This part of the world is very very Brisbane-like in its climate, I think.
I think that's true with the humidity in through a lot of the year, but the pleasant weather, especially in winter.
Yeah, well, look, it's a heavy conversation in some ways we've got ahead of us today.
Yes.
Around your new book, Life After Doom, which is, what's the release date? Is it May? This
May.
Is coming out?
Yes.
Okay, so this probably a little bit after this podcast goes up, so people can go and pre-order it now as they hear this. But it is a conversation about the end of the world, really. So settle in, take a seat. But perhaps not entirely in the way that you might think. This book, and I think it really interestingly picks up off the back of your last two books, which we've chatted with you about, Faith After Doubt and Do I Stay Christian, which are perhaps naming what's been happening in the religious movements around the world from a real zoomed out perspective. This sort of names what's happening in the world as a whole from a real zoomed out perspective, looking at the climate catastrophe, the economic dilemma, and perhaps the earliest days of the collapse of the Western Empire. When did you know, Brian, that this was what you needed to write next?
Well, in 2006, 2007, I was writing a book called Everything Must Change. And it felt like the most important book that I had ever written and that I would write. But I remember thinking, if I live long enough, it'll be interesting to see how things unfold, because that was a book about global crises. And so I had a feeling that I might come back to that subject of global crises. But as I was planning for my next two books with my publisher, I'd said, I think I want to address the issue of despair, because so many of my friends and colleagues in the activist community face, as we're facing the facts, we're feeling hopeless. And I wanted to address that. I didn't know what the answer was, but that was a problem I felt I should deal with. And then I have another book that will probably be my next book that is about the meaning of life. It's called The Beautiful Logic of a Meaningful Life. And what happened is my editor said, I really think you should do that Doom book first, because she said, I think that's where so many of us are. So,
do you ever stop writing? That's incredible. I swear we just chatted to you about your last two books. Now this one's out and another one on the way.
Well, I haven't started the next one yet, but I'm very lucky, Dom. I love to write. So, and I feel it's an honor to be able to do for other people. I mean, I love to read, so to be able to do for other people what so many great authors have done for me.
Well, please do keep writing. It is a great gift to us. And you probably introduced the scope of this book perfectly early on, where you write that Life After Doom is for everyone who has reached a point where not facing their unpeaceful, uneasy, unwanted feelings about the future has become more draining than facing them. It's for anyone who understands that we've entered a dangerous time and we need to prepare ourselves to face that danger with wisdom, courage, character, and compassion. I said to you at dinner last night, it felt to me kind of like reading the book, particularly the early chapters, was almost like I was being grabbed by the shoulders and gently moved to face the thing that sort of lingers just out of vision all day, every day. Because that is how it is for many of us, isn't it? That it's there's this awareness that we know what we're facing, but the daily work of a human life sort of just churns on with that lingering over us.
I think so. And I think on some deep level, it's affecting all of us. It's like a slow leak in a tire, you know?
Yes.
And I think many of us, we just know if I face it, it's going to take a lot out of me. And so we, as you say, we keep it just at the periphery of our vision. That's understandable. And many people, as I say in the book, I think they've got enough trouble in their life. They don't need to think about anything beyond surviving another day.
Yeah, yeah.
But for those of us who have the bandwidth, and for those of us who realize me keeping this at bay is taking something from me too, I think then for us it becomes worthwhile. At least I know it was for me.
Yeah.
I felt like, okay, it's time. I need to try to face reality in the most honest way I can.
It felt a little bit like, an you know, I've had this happen in friendships or relationships or employment, when there's a sort of a big thing in the room that's not being spoken about, the elephant in the room.
Yes.
And that runs the whole show. There's this anxious energy, this slightly yes. uneasy energy. And then finally, when someone puts it all on the table, no yeah. matter how dire the situation might be, at least you then know what you're working with.
Yes, yes. I'm thinking we need a new metaphor. Maybe we could say the melting glacier in the room. or the, you know, rising sea level in the room, or whatever.
Yeah. Well, look, you beautifully have this way in your work of structuring approaches to things, of breaking down very complex situations into sort of frameworks that we can wrap our heads around a little bit more easily. And you do that wonderfully here. With the outline of the book sort of moves through another four-stage process of responding to this crisis, which begins with letting go, moving into letting be, then moving towards letting come, and on to setting free. That's the four-stage model you use. Can you speak a little bit about that four-stage model?
Sure. Well, I remember a very simple concept was presented by a number of authors and thinkers I respect a great deal, Margaret Wheatley and Peter Senge and others. They talked about theory U as a path of descent, like going down, hitting bottom and coming back up. That's a familiar framework in Alcoholics Anonymous and other addiction recovery groups. But it's also what people in the Christian tradition often call the Paschal mystery. It's death, burial, resurrection. Mm. In this case, it seems to me, as you know, I have an interest in the subject of biases and how our brains both help us face the truth but also shield us from the truth sometimes.
Yes.
And I'm interested in the process of how we get beyond those defense mechanisms against things we need to know but don't really want to know.
Yeah.
That's the letting go process. And then what I have to admit, this is true of me, whenever I begin to face things that I don't want to face, I just want to fix it as fast as I can and move on, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But that's where the letting be phase becomes important, to not fix it till I really let it settle.
Yes.
And then we can move on to seeing what comes when I face it without a neurotic fixing reaction. And then there's a certain sense, once you face the worst, you're free, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I think people who receive a horrible medical diagnosis, they go through a period where they let go of how they thought their life was going to be. Then it settles in. Okay, the future's going to be shorter than I thought, or different than I thought. And then new inspiration comes and new possibilities come, and then you're free to live whatever time and conditions you have left. And very often those are the best times in a person's life.
Yeah, it's, you know, I had this image as I was reading you talk through this four-stage process there. Almost like it's a bit like a lung, in a sense, taking a big breath in, letting that breath just sit, then, or maybe it's taking a big breath out, more so, letting that sit, then breathing in what comes and letting that sustain you going forward.
Yes.
So there is something very natural about this cycle.
Yes, that's right. It's the breath process. It's the coming and going of a season. It's birth, growth, death.
And it's the healthiest way to handle this immense crisis that we are facing as a species. And so as you do in the book, and you do on a number of occasions say this start will be heavy, chapter 2 in particular, you say, you know, if you need to put this down for a bit, that's okay. And And I did have moments where I noticed myself thinking, oh, I could go and watch a comedy again. I could pick up that novel I was reading. It's a lot. It's necessary, but it is a lot that you begin with in the idea of letting go. So stick with us here, because the letting come and the setting free is on its way. But we begin with the letting go. Mm. And in chapter two, you do lay out probably the clearest picture I've come across of what we are facing as a species. Particularly the four scenarios that are in front of us from an ecological perspective. Scenario one you call collapse avoidance. Scenario two is collapse rebirth. Scenario three is collapse survival. And scenario four is collapse extinction. I think it'd be helpful to talk through those four scenarios a little bit. Can you tell me a bit about how you found your way to these four scenarios and then a bit about them?
Well, as you can imagine, I spent literally hundreds and hundreds of hours really trying to immerse myself in the state of the art thinking about our current situation, which that little phrase, our current situation, I use a lot in the book.
Yes.
It's not just climate change, although climate change is very, very central to it. But it's climate change relating to, in conversation with political failure, political polarization. Obviously, we feel that in my country in an acute way, especially this year, as we watch a kind of nightmarish, almost zombie-like return of Donald Trump and his it's hard to call it an ideology, but his reaction. So there's an ecological dimension, there's a political dimension, there's around the world, there's this contraction into a kind of ethno-nationalist authoritarianism. And then meanwhile, we have a class of people, a very small percentage of people who are accumulating unimaginable wealth. And it's not just numbers on a bank account, it's the amount of power that they have because of that wealth. Someone well known in Australia who owns a global media empire, who has made the world, I think most of us would agree, an immeasurably worse place by his media empire that he uses because he wants the world to be the way he wants it rather than the way other people want it. So, in fact, this is a tangent, but just the other day I listened to a podcast where the podcaster was saying there are three great superpowers in the world.
Okay.
The United States, still probably a waning superpower, China, and the oligarchs or the hyper extreme rich who own media, who can manipulate everyone's minds.
Wow.
And he made the case that those people who own these huge media companies, Rupert Murdoch, Elon Musk, all the rest, that they are superpowers in themselves, and especially when their interests align. All that's to say, we have this current situation that is unsustainable, and we think if we could just solve this or this or this, we'd be fine. But you put these problems together, and you realize that the letting go is the letting go of the illusion that normalcy is inevitable, and that normalcy is unshakable. And when you realize how fragile what we call normal is, even that the idea of progress that many of us just, it's so built into us. We see the world through lenses of progress. The idea that that regression could never happen, that becomes an illusion that we begin to let go of. It doesn't mean we're sure of what will happen, but it means we've lost our certainty that normalcy will continue to happen.
And it's interesting as you say that, because that is something I think a lot of our eyes are being slowly open to in recent years is, I mean, I even think when I graduated from high school in 2010, there was still a sense, it was 2 years after Obama in the US, the climate science had certainly come a long way in terms of public narrative, but it probably hadn't fully taken over as it has today. And so I graduated with a sense of hope and optimism and ambition into the world that now at the high school I work at, I can see the seniors who graduate just over a decade on, they aren't graduating into that same sense of a world that awaits them. So there is an awareness that's crept in bit by bit that this thing that we've all just sort of taken for granted, it's the rails ahead of us aren't looking safe and sturdy anymore.
I think that's a good way to say it.
So as a result of that, and you know, you can look at this economically, you can look at this from climate, whatever you want, whatever the, as you said, our current situation is, there are four possible scenarios that await us. The most hopeful, optimistic, best case scenario is the one you describe as collapse avoidance. Tell me a bit about collapse avoidance.
Yes, and I should say, best case, at least in the short run.
Yes.
But collapse avoidance would mean that somehow, in the face of our current situation of ecological overshoot, meaning that we're sucking more resources out of the earth than the earth can continue to produce, and we're pumping out more wastes, toxins, pollutants, and so on, that then the earth can detoxify, which means we've got a situation that's unsustainable. We somehow come together and do what's necessary to keep the balance of nature from tipping off balance.
Sure.
And that's collapse avoidance.
Yeah. So that's the best case scenario in many ways for the short term, as you said, and we will unpack going forward that it could just be a Band-Aid fix that screws us over more in the long term. But collapse avoidance is scenario one. Then the sort of progressively moving down the chain of disaster, scenario two is collapse rebirth.
Yes. And really, this is the idea that hit me back in 2006, 2007, when I was writing this book, Everything Must Change. I came across a group of scholars and thinkers and activists back then who were saying the global economy is unsalvageable and it's unsustainable, and so it will collapse. Now, it's very easy for people to say that, but there's a huge death toll in that collapse.
Yeah.
It's not a happy scenario, but what they were doing is they were facing that and saying, but after the collapse of the global economy, we'll have to rebuild something. And they're saying a lot of us should start putting our creativity and our energy into the kind of life and the kind of world that we would like there to be after this global economy that's based on militarism and based on gross inequalities of rich and poor. They're saying we could imagine a better world after the collapse, not to minimize the horror of the collapse, but we can imagine a better world. Let's start preparing for that now. And that's collapse rebirth.
Yeah, which, you know, very much has roots in the, as you mentioned, the Paschal mystery, the death and resurrection idea that, and we can all see this in our personal lives, that often after a horrible event has occurred, sometime afterwards, some new, greater, deeper, richer sense of us and our lives emerges on the other side. So actually, as terrible as the death is, in a sense, it's necessary to find our way to the new horizon.
This is where science to me is, people often think of science as depressing and religion inspiring. I find sometimes religion is very depressing and science is really inspiring. But, you know, something science tells us is that we've had five great extinction events in before human history in the history of the Earth. A lot of people know about a big asteroid hitting the Earth. Catastrophic effect, destruction of the dinosaurs in part. But after each of these extinction events, there's this incredible flowering. It's like the deck of cards has been reshuffled and new things are possible. Resources have been redistributed. New arrangements are possible. And so it's built deeply into the fabric of the universe. You know, people say this, this is well known now, but when you think that you and I sitting here, every atom and molecule in our bodies has been part of stars collapsing and re-exploding, that we're here experiencing this moment of connection and conversation and consciousness and communication. We're experiencing this with an airplane flying overhead. We're experiencing this in the aftermath of unimaginable catastrophes in the past.
Yeah.
So, and there is, if you want to call it hope, and I'm sure we'll talk about the fact that hope is complicated in my mind, but if you want to talk about hope, that's deeply rooted in the way the universe has unfolded.
Yeah. It rarely ever is it the rebirth that we might have envisioned or
yes, that's right.
decided we wanted, because that would still be the old paradigm. But yes. in some way, it's deeper and richer and yes, bigger.
Exactly right. Yeah.
And it's interesting when you say that, because that's I think I was thinking about our current setup in the world, our current situation, kind of like a strained, toxic marriage potentially after a couple of decades.
Yeah.
And how collapse avoidance in that scenario is just maybe going on a good holiday that restores a little bit of a spark for 6 months.
Yes.
But fundamentally, the core problems in the relationship haven't been yes. addressed or looked at or healed. Whereas collapse rebirth feels much more like, in some way, whether it's time apart, whether it's a divorce, whether it's therapy, whatever
yes.
it could be,
yes.
the core thing gets looked at
yes.
and an actual wholehearted new way forward emerges out of
yes.
it. Yeah.
Yes, yes, that's well said.
So collapse rebirth then, in my sense, is actually possibly, and I say this knowing
yeah,
the immense death toll involved, but quite hopeful for the future of reality.
Yes.
The next two are a little bit less so.
Yeah.
Scenario three is collapse survival.
Yes. So this scenario basically says collapse will happen. It's inevitable. And by the way, that word collapse is a terrifying word, but every single civilization up until this one has collapsed.
Yeah. Yes.
So collapse is, I think we're foolish to think we'll beat the odds on that.
There's a hubris in that, isn't there, that we have?
That's right. There's a hubris and a naivete and so on. Although I should also say, if there could be a deep and profound awareness and coming together, collapses can be more or less catastrophic.
Yes.
You can make things a lot worse in the way you respond to the early stages of collapse. So, but assuming that some kind of collapse of our global, technological, militaristic, capitalistic civilization were inevitable, a complete collapse might not result in the extinction of our species. And here is where it turns out there's a whole field called collapsology. and there are right. serious people. I mean, a lot of people would know a famous book called The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire by Gibbons. And so people have been paying attention to how empires rise and fall for a long time. But one of the interesting conclusions of a lot of collapsologists is that the normal state of human beings is, you might call it feudalism, you might call it dictatorship, but it seems to be when a civilization collapses, you end up with these regional authoritarian regimes where okay. somebody acts as the feudal lord. And in some ways, this is a person who's willing to employ violence on a level that is morally unacceptable to most people. Mm. And everyone is forced to live under the protection of one of these extraordinarily violent people who amasses wealth and power and uses it for the benefit of his fiefdom, or his little mini kingdom. And
so this has happened after civilization collapses.
Yes.
Again and again. Right.
Well, I remember one author said it like this. He said, if you look at the life of a serf in Egypt in 2100 BC, and you look at the life of a serf in Europe in the 19th century, a poor person in Europe, their lives were not that different.
Hmm.
It's an interesting thought.
Yeah, right. Okay. So in that sense, collapse survival is the civilization collapses, but instead of the previous option where rebirth happens and a new way forward emerges, we sort of move into the, I think you used the Mad Max analogy in there, we move into this post-apocalyptic sort of wasteland where there's this squabbling over resources that are left and things get pretty ugly pretty quickly.
I mean, getting there would certainly be ugly. And then people would have to pick up the pieces and try to make something work. And you know, people, some people in more progressive circles speak very glibly about, oh, burn it all down, let it all burn down. But they don't realize what happens when your systems of justice and education and food distribution and all the rest, banking, business, all of those systems are shaken or corrupted or severely weakened. It's a new arrangement, let's say it that way.
So we have collapse avoidance, where we avoid the scenario, collapse to some extent at least, collapse rebirth, where it does collapse and something new emerges from it, collapse survival, where it collapses and we find ourselves into a bit of a dystopian future where things are vastly different from what we could imagine and not in many good ways. And then scenario four is, at least for the human species, endgame. Collapse / extinction.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, first, we realize, you know, it's something that's just happened in my lifetime is we made these huge breakthroughs in archaeology, studying human species. We found out that we knew about the Neanderthals, and we find out about the Denisovans, and we realized, you know, our common ancestor Homo erectus. There were these humanoid species, hominin species, they're often called, that lived for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years, but then they went extinct. And the possibility of human extinction, many people, at first glance, they think, oh, that would never happen. It has happened.
Yeah.
And then when you realize that we human beings are, our current situation is far more fragile than we realize, and our power to disrupt the planet, whether the two easiest scenarios to imagine are climate change that results in such a reconfiguration of the Earth. I mean, it's possible that we could blow our planetary climate system so far out of balance that it would be that the Earth could be uninhabitable for life beyond that lives. You know, some people would say vertebrate life could disappear. This has happened before in previous extinction events where, you know, virtually all animal life was wiped out that lived on the land and in shallow seas. I mean, that sort of thing has happened in the past. If that seems unimaginable to people, a little more research, they would find out that it's not so unimaginable. They could imagine if a huge meteor hit the Earth, or maybe more, they could imagine, what if there was a desperate all-out nuclear war?
Yes.
And when they imagine that, they can realize, yeah, we really could, we could change the conditions of the Earth.
Yeah. And helpfully with all of these, I think, and this is all through your book, is remembering or getting the perspective of us being at one point in a continuum, rather than the end of history idea that many of us have, that everything has been building to where we are today.
Yes.
That we are just one more plot point in a much bigger unfolding story. And we have no idea where the story's going next.
Yes.
But people, if people do survive this, you know, if humans do make it to the other side, in a sense, and we'll get to that shortly, but that in a few thousand years, they'll be looking back at us like we look back at the Roman Empire.
Yes.
And, yeah.
That's a perspective that is a little hard to, as you said, get sort of a high altitude view. It's a little hard to get that high.
Yes.
But once you get there, it helps. You know, it's funny, in my research, something really was quite, I don't know, it had a big effect on me. I came across a quote from two early Christian leaders, Augustine and Jerome, during the 100, 150 years when the Roman Empire was really collapsing. And one of the things I think it's important to realize, your civilization can be collapsing and you don't realize it.
But
there was an invasion of Rome, and Jerome basically freaked out. He just thought, how can we imagine any future with Rome destroyed? And he was just undone by this, you know. St. Augustine says, listen, people, remember, empires rise and fall. This has happened before. Mm-hmm. It's not the end of the world. I think if we're willing to go to a high enough altitude, it helps us. And here's the irony for people like me. You know, I was a pastor for 24 years. I'm a committed Christian. Even though I have deep frustrations and misgivings about the direction of the Christian religion at the moment, you realize that in our religious tradition, there is so much to tell us. Civilizations rise and fall.
Yeah.
We're looking for something that's more dependable than an economic system or ideology or political regime.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's really helpful to view it that way. And that leads to, as you said, a broader perspective on how we got here and where we might be going. Yeah. If those are the four scenarios, then collapse avoidance, collapse rebirth, collapse survival, and collapse extinction, which I've never heard it or read it put like that, sort of it's a choose your own adventure book in a sense.
It is.
And
yeah.
Humanity has those four pathways available to us. You do cover the fact that many experts are starting to think that the first two scenarios, that collapse avoidance and collapse rebirth, are growing less and less likely. And the last two, collapse survival and collapse extinction, are becoming more likely outcomes.
Could I just make a comment on that?
Yes.
I don't want to overstate it to say many experts are thinking about this. Here's the reality. Our world is so complex that nobody can be an expert about everything.
Sure, sure.
And so most experts are experts in a very narrow field.
Yeah.
So there are people whose whole lives are dedicated to understanding the ocean currents that have a huge effect on our planetary conditions. Mm. There are other people whose whole lives are invested in understanding one ice sheet on Greenland or one part of the Greenland ice sheet others on the Antarctic ice sheet. So there are relatively few experts who zoom out from their area of expertise and try to understand the interaction of many areas of expertise. Mm. And doing so we realize that we have to be humble, that there's so much we don't understand. But when you have more and more people paying attention to the bigger picture, any kind of naive optimism is becoming rare.
Yeah, yeah, and we will get onto hope in a moment, as you've mentioned, which is a very complex thing. But as we move towards the end of letting go, before we move into letting be, you talk in that section of the book about the idea of overshoot potentially being civilization's original sin.
Yes,
and I was so struck by that idea. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yes. So you think, oh, our problem is fossil fuels. Well, it is. Our urgent and immediate problem is fossil fuels. There is no doubt about that. But if you were to say, how did we get into a situation where we would exploit fossil fuels so with such abandon and with such addiction, so no plan B, you know, how did we get into this? Then you realize this really, you can start going, you go back farther and farther and farther. And you realize that the agricultural revolution, which begins to unfold something like 10,000 BC, was the point at which we learned how to exploit the environment to produce more energy than we needed so that people could then begin to accumulate energy, accumulate power. And what began to happen is people would produce more children than their land could sustain long term, which would then require them to go acquire more land and more land and more land. And once you need to acquire more and more land because you have a continually growing population that makes continually greater demands on the earth, you realize you're on a trajectory that will eventually reach limits.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's such a fascinating idea of living within the harmony of creation or exploiting the harmony of creation.
Yeah.
And I think about how much this has to do with control and how much this has to do with things that we can see on a personal level, how damaging they are and how they leak out. And also on a much bigger cosmic level that we weren't, in a sense, made to live like this. In a sense, it is the disruption of the harmony and the flow of creation.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And of course, something I do in the book is I look back at the Genesis story and say, what if the actual meaning of the Genesis story had nothing to do with who goes to heaven and who goes to hell? It has nothing to do with that. Yes. It's not in the story at all. But what if this is in the ancient literacy of storytelling? The way that we say, we humans used to live as hunter-gatherers, and the earth was our garden. But eventually, we weren't satisfied with that, and we wanted to go beyond the limits of our environment, and we wanted to be like gods. We didn't want to live within it. We wanted to live above it and control it.
Yeah.
That suddenly seems incredibly relevant, you know.
Doesn't it? Genesis suddenly becomes the book of our times
in a really does.
Profound way. And it's interesting you mention this, actually, because one part of the book, this is a slight tangent, but I wanted to mention this because I was really, I sort of took a deep breath out as I read this. People like you, Brian, have spent a number of years deconstructing all narratives of the angry gods, you know, of God having this wrath against humanity and all these sorts of things for very helpful reasons. That narrative has caused a lot of people a lot of pain in many ways. However, you do write in the book that you've come to see that these stories actually might have served a purpose and had a place.
Yes.
Can you talk a bit about why?
Yes. Well, first of all, can I just say I really appreciate you reading the book that closely and seeing that, because that's a little like one paragraph in the book. And sometimes authors feel like this is a really important paragraph. I wonder if anyone will notice it, and to have somebody notice it is a good thing. So, in the book of Genesis, God, the character God, and I think it's not the only way to read the book of Genesis, but to read it like a story where God is a character in the story.
Yes. Yeah.
And God says, on the day you eat of the fruit I've forbidden you, I've given you a limit. On the day you go beyond that limit, you're dead. You know, it becomes a way of saying that humans live with that the book is trying to tell us that there's a power greater than ourselves that tells us there are limits. And if we exceed those limits, we're going to reap what we sow. We're going to have bitter consequences. And that gets turned into all kinds of abusive structures of religion, of a punishing, vicious, angry God, who then can be used by demagogues and authoritarians, religious or political, to put the fear of God in people, which is really the fear of me as the guy with the power, right? But what if there's deeper wisdom there? And that wisdom is, if you don't live within the limits that the earth can provide, it will not go well for you. Extinction will follow.
Yes.
You know? Yeah, and in this way, the book of Genesis is saying what Charles Darwin said. And Charles Darwin wasn't contradicting Genesis. He was making the deepest point of Genesis, which is you only survive if you fit with your environment.
Yes. Yeah, that's wonderful. And totally redeems thousands of years of our tradition of, you know, that we can sometimes condescendingly look at and go, how did they believe in this angry, vengeful, divine power? And then you think, no, these stories were getting at the harmony, in a sense, and what happens when you disturb the harmony. Not that there's someone up there who's now going to punish you for it, but that it's sort of like, you know, if you push that button, the repercussions of pushing that button are the punishment itself, not something dealt down from above.
And could I just flesh that out a bit? So I think about farmers of two or three or four generations ago who inherited land that they cared for. They inherited a wisdom that said, you better take care of the soil, and then the soil will take care of you. If you don't take care of the soil, you're going to be hungry someday, right?
Yeah,
that wasn't a vengeful soil. That was just realism about the environment.
Yes.
Then what happened in the 20th century with the invention of fertilizers, which have all kinds of blessings as well as all kinds of downsides, right? And the inventions of pesticides. Farmers didn't need to think about taking care of the soil anymore. They just needed to think about killing bugs and pumping in nitrogen and potassium and sodium and so on. So Yeah,
that's fascinating. I think that's going to change every time now that I reread parts of the Bible that speak about, you know, the angry God in any sense. That's going to change my whole perspective on that quite profoundly. And so, look, that's letting go. That's letting go of our fear of looking at how things are, and letting go of our sense of denial and just sort of the deep surrender. And then we move into letting be, because at this stage, generally, one of two things, I think we sort of feel pulled in one of two extremes. Mm-hmm. The hope that, well, everything works out, things are wonderful. I've seen Disney movies.
Yes.
Things work themselves out. That's one way we can lean. And then the other way we can be pulled is complete despair and sort of nihilism that, well, doesn't matter. It's all pointless. It's all useless. Both hope and despair in that sense, both are going to destroy us in a sense. What do you do when you find yourself in one of those two extremes, when you feel pulled in one of those directions?
Yes, well, the first thing I should say is, in the process of writing this book, I felt this happening to me.
Right.
I was pulled toward everything will be okay. Everything will be okay. Nothing this bad could happen. Or it's all is lost. Why even try? We are so screwed, right?
Yes.
So I felt it, even though I was trying to understand this, it still worked. And I think it just helps people to remember that our brains are biological organisms that have evolved to solve problems. And one of our problems that our brains have to solve is when things look difficult, our brains have to tell us, don't give up, hang in there, don't give up, don't give up. But there are times where our brains have to say, we're beating our head against a wall here. It's time to stop doing this, right?
Yes.
Our heads will be bashed in before the wall falls. So our brains have to monitor this. And it's very easy for us to only allow one of those two sort of hemispheres of the brain to have a vote.
Yeah. And the problem is both of them lead to complacency, as you write.
This is the problem. What our brain really wants is to be at a state of rest and peace.
Yes.
It wants to conserve energy. And so if you tell me everything's going to be okay, I can return to my previously scheduled complacency. Or there's nothing you can do. Nothing you can do. It's hopeless. You can return to your previously scheduled complacency. You can go watch another comedy, you know? And it's understandable our brains want to be like that. And where that really gets us in trouble is when we live in a situation where all is not lost, but our current strategies for survival will not get us through. That's when we have a moment where we need to neither give up nor rest that everything's going to be okay. It's where we have to say a new option is needed, a new creative possibility is needed, and we don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And that's what happens when we let go of our illusion and now we're willing to let be and face the gravity of our situation, the impotence of our current strategies, or insufficiency of our current strategies. And now we have to, in a sense, be willing to sit without knowing.
Yeah. And I'm moving a little bit ahead here. Yeah. So we'll come back in a moment. But towards the end of the book, you write about this sense that we all have a little chip to bring to this picture. Because sometimes I think when the scale of the problem that we're facing it becomes clear, you can feel this sense that, well, I need to look into a compost garden. I need to run a support group for dealing with the mental health side of this. I need to convert all of my electricity to being green. Like there can be this weight on the individual that you need to be able to somehow meet all of the economic and environmental problems we're facing by yourself and solve them. Almost find this sense of purity in your own life.
Yes.
Individualistic purity on this front. And that's the only way forward. But you kind of say towards the end of the book, instead of feeling, because that just makes us feel overwhelmed, it's too much alongside a normal life to get across all of that.
Yeah.
You kind of move us towards a place of going, what can I do? What is actually my chip to bring to this mosaic? What is my role to play?
Yes.
And I just wanted to mention that because I found that a really helpful way of responding to the overwhelming sense of things, that I'm probably not going to be the one here to develop a new way of farming that changes the whole game.
Yeah.
That's not my role to play in this scenario,
yeah.
in this situation. So,
But when I can stand back and say, thank God that there are all of these agriculturalists and yes. agronomists and plant geneticists, and they are developing... one of the most exciting, beautiful things, people, we've 12,000 years of agriculture on farming perennial crops.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, on farming annual crops, crops that grow and die in one season. And we are just beginning to develop perennial architecture, agriculture. And there are these scientists that are saying, this is the most exciting field, to think of grains that come up every year that you don't have to till and plow and replant. Oh my gosh. Then suddenly you have this appreciation for people who they're making it. It requires thousands of people, 40 hours a week plus,
yes.
focusing on one tiny problem.
Yes. Yes.
And we need them to do what they're doing. And rather than tell them, that's not going to solve the problem, just give up. Well, it won't solve the problem alone, but yeah.
It's a beautiful sort of orchestral image
of
people playing their part in the bigger. Right. Yeah. So as we sit in the space of letting things be, not rushing to fix them in any meaningful way, I wanted to ask you at this stage, before you move into letting come and setting free, this deep dive you've taken in this research and after you let go and sort of let be and see how the situation really is, ontologically, what has this made you think about the human condition? Because this is such a big question that we wrestle with often. Are humans inherently good or inherently bad? I know that your good friend Richard Rohr's work around original sin or original blessing is so central to this. Looking at the situation we've got ourselves in and the original sin, as you mentioned, of overshoot, has it shifted your ontological view of the human species and the human condition?
Wow, I love that question. Dom, here's what I'd say. It has made me realize that all of the available traditional interpretations or responses to that question, I don't think are satisfying to me.
Okay.
So it opens up that question again. And if I were to say where I feel at this moment, having written this book, and what I'd say is, I think the psychologists have this idea of neuroplasticity. I think one of the amazing things about the human species is that we are very plastic. We can live in very, very different ways. But our civilization has brought us, almost all of us on the planet, to live in one certain way, or if not to live that way, to aspire to live in that way.
Sure.
And I think that set of assumptions is super, super dangerous. It's run its course. It doesn't have a good future. Now, if you believe that that's the only way human beings can live, then you'll become a misanthrope, or you'll become cynical about the human species. But if you step back and say, hold it, there are very different ways for us to live. There are different value systems. Like, I'm working on a science fiction novel, and on another planet, human beings are living, and the idea of money would never cross their mind.
Sure, sure.
Well, we're so based around money. Could we imagine a way living without money? Well, what would be that different way of living? So that's, to me, where I think there's incredible possibilities for the human species. But this is now where language like death and resurrection, the death of the old humanity and the resurrection of a new humanity, suddenly doesn't become a theological framing, it becomes an anthropological framing, right?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, and there is this beautiful idea in our tradition that, of a divine who will seek out any barrier between us and love, anything that's holding us back from life, and try to remove it, destroy it in some meaningful way. And I do kind of, I think reading the book made me think that about what we're currently facing is all our language is around what an awful thing it is that, that we're going through. But perhaps in a sense, it is life trying to heal us, trying to course correct us, saying, yes. no, you're not made to live like this. I'm not giving up on you. I'm bringing you back in some grisly way. But yeah, and that might move us a little bit towards letting come, I think. Yeah. And you write, I think it's early on in that part of the book, other civilizations have collapsed and some people survived it. Now it's our turn. And that moves from this disempowered state that I probably felt at the beginning of the letting go. Mm. And then the deep breath out, the Holy Saturday period of the letting be. Mm. And then letting come is this sense of, all right, now it's our turn. What happens now? Tell me a little bit about the stage of letting come that comes next.
Well, one of the things that was helpful for me, you know, as a educated, privileged white male who lives in one of the world's fading but remaining superpowers and so on, is this sense, I've been so brainwashed or formed to see the world in a certain way. Mm. And what I look at as the last 500 years of technological advancement and progress and so on, for many people, the colonized people, it was the end of the world for them. What was the beginning of the world that I thrive in was the end of the world that they thrived in. And so this little phrase, we're not the first ones here, that phrase really has helped me. Here meaning realizing that a way of life that we cherish, that's the only way of life we know, is coming to an end. Because when you realize that, then new things become possible.
Mm. Yeah. And you do say that early on in this part of the book, that we can learn from our indigenous people who in and through colonization have already experienced the end of their world in a profound way. So what we're all scared about facing in the next couple of hundred years, the indigenous peoples of the world can tell us, oh yeah, we faced that. We've walked that path.
Yeah.
But what can we learn from them about how you get through this?
And this is where the irony is, you know, Jesus had this saying, the meek shall inherit the earth. And my friend, John Deere, a Jesuit, beautiful Jesuit, brother, says that the meek shall inherit the earth means the nonviolent shall inherit the earth. Mm. Or we might say the ecologically gentle, those who live in harmony with the earth and one another shall inherit the earth. Well, you realize that while civilizations were building their armies and building their tall buildings and all the rest, there were these people who lived close to the ground. Mm. And they, none of them were perfect, but they had ways of life that they could be sustained on the land for hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years. And they developed a set of values that helped them do that. And those of us who thought of ourselves as the conquerors, the conquistadors, or the descendants of the colonizers, we thought, oh, they were losers. Well, no, they were only losers because the arrogant and violent came and dispossessed them. Yeah. So this becomes a time, not to be naive or romantic or anything else about this, but to say, no, there are people who lived in harmony with the land far better than we are doing, and their wisdom would be a good thing for us to turn to now.
And this maybe moves us into the idea of safe landings that you write about in the Letting Come part of the book. Can you speak a bit about where you came across that term, safe landings, and what it means?
Well, as part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the largest scientific endeavor in the history of humanity, we could say in the history of the solar system at least, and maybe the galaxy, who knows, We've got incredible array and coordination of scientists who are trying to help us understand what's actually happening on this planet. Mm. And then there are a group of them who've said, okay, we need to look at the mess we're in and try to imagine possible safe landings. And the image of an airplane in flight that knows it's in trouble. We're not going to make it to the destination we thought we were. We're not going to fly forever. what's an emergency landing we can make that would be safe and helpful? Mm. That image, I think, is a useful image.
Yeah, that's a really, really helpful one. And I think it's in that part of the book that you're writing about your friend who was taking a flying lesson and learned something very interesting about what you should do when there's turbulence in a flight.
Yes, my friend Cameron Trimble, a beautiful author and leader, her flight instructor said to her, when you're in turbulence, don't grab hold of your controls, feverishly like you'll be tempted to do. You've got to fly loose because the more you seize control, the more the less control you have in super turbulent conditions.
Yeah, and there's all that beautiful imagery around a loose grip, not a tight grip. Yes. And I think if there's one thing that could sum up a lot of what we're seeing in the Western world at the moment, and not just the Western world, but is grips are tightening at the exact time they maybe need to start loosening instead. Yes. And that is about to move us towards setting free. But before we get there, I want to ask you about one part of the book that comes in the Letting Come part, where you mention your surprised realization that you are no longer interested in saving this civilization, at least not as it is, but you're interested in something else. Mm. And you write in the book that you aren't sure yet how to describe what that something else you're interested in is.
Yeah.
It's been a couple of months since you wrote that. Mm. Have you gotten any closer to being able to put words to what it is you're interested in rather than saving this civilization as it is?
So one of the things that has been happening to me, just as a fact of my life, that is a convergence of my lifelong interest in spirituality, the Bible, Christian faith, Jesus, his life and teaching, my lifelong interest in science, my adult interest in politics and economics and so on, history, is that I don't think about human beings as separate from mammals.
Sure.
And I don't think of mammals as separate from birds and reptiles and amphibians and arachnids and arthropods and all the rest. And I don't think of animal life as separate from plant life. And I don't think of animal and plant life as separate from soil and water and air. And I don't think of the earth as separate from the sun.
Sure.
What starts to happen is you start to feel how connected everything is. And if you only care about saving one piece, then you're willing to hurt the whole to save the piece. Mm. But when you realize that every piece is dependent on the whole, it's a different way of looking at what your hopes are.
Oh, I love that so much.
Thanks.
You were talking cosmic level zooming out here.
Yeah.
But I totally agree with you. I've always used to think this when I was growing up in a church that spoke a lot about the afterlife, that their notion of a heaven or a hell was such a small, zoomed-in human perspective. This idea that my human consciousness will move to another place to continue its human consciousness in this identity, rather than seeing everything as an expression of form that comes from source.
Yes.
And that's such a different relationship, isn't it, to think of it that way?
Oh, my. Oh, my. And you know, again, mortality rates are still very high, right? All of us are going to die. Death is part of life. And I have a chapter about that in the book, that I think are running away from the reality of death, and our Band-Aids and aspirin that we try to, treat ourselves with, rather than facing the incredible gift of life, which includes its brevity, right? Yes. All of that, I think, super important. And I realize that my religious tradition has been trying to solve one problem in a way that created a whole lot of other problems. And I don't want to minimize that it did a great job of helping many people solve one problem, but that also doesn't erase the fact that it created other problems.
Yeah.
And so somehow moving forward, we're going to have to recalibrate. And this is why a lot of us are involved in deconstructing our inherited theologies, not to destroy them, but because their current construction is not the only possible construction, and it has a lot of serious downsides.
And I think when you move into that mystical sense of oneness that you can find in any tradition, really, yeah. and in no tradition. You know, yeah. wherever you look, humans have stumbled into these experiences yes. and these encounters every now and then. It makes you realize that who knows what's going to happen to this civilization? Who knows what's going to happen to the human species? And there is certainly work to be done, but there is a much bigger picture of yeah. all of this. And perhaps a line about that stuck out to me profoundly was in the Hope is Complicated chapter of the book, where you mentioned something that a friend of yours said to her, that she used to think hope was the confidence that the thing that she fears won't happen, and now she thinks that hope is the confidence that what she fears will happen, but that she doesn't have to be afraid. That is such a massive shift of understanding hope, isn't it?
I just loved it when she said that to me. I just yes. thought, yeah, you somehow captured it.
Yes.
Retreating from things we fear solves the problem, but it doesn't, it creates new problems.
Yes.
But facing the things we fear to the point where we realize that we don't need to be afraid of them, yeah, it's very, very different. And, you know, again, here's where the Christian faith, people, right at the point where people are throwing it out, they realize, oh, you know what? It could be seen in a different way.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's this sense, why are these Christians putting crosses everywhere? And Catholics especially have a dying man on a cross. Well, one thing you could say about that is that this is a big death avoidance strategy. Jesus did all the dying, so we don't have to.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's
yeah.
another way to say it. No, Jesus' life and death are both trying to help us face the realities of our own life and death.
Yes.
And it could be that way, you know? Yeah. Just as I said that the human, our human hardware is very plastic. Hmm. We could say that, you know, the resources of the Christian faith or the Jewish faith or the Muslim or Hindu faith, they have enormous possibilities, and there's not only one way to configure them.
You write towards the end of the book about this moment, I think you were fishing, and you had one of those mystical moments of realizing everything is energy.
Yeah.
And that part of the book, I mean, the whole book is spectacular, but that it's worth buying the book just for that page or two, because it felt like, to me, reading that was a bit like reading Thomas Merton's Fourth and Walnut story of realizing everything around him was shining like the sun.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that moment you had of waking up again to yeah. something you've probably in some ways always intellectually known, yeah. but experiencing this awareness that everything is just energy moving.
Yeah, you know, well, in some ways, it's one of the reasons I know it's so easy for people to get little sound bites of information in a tweet or whatever it's called now, or, you know, a little post. But there are certain things that it almost takes 12 or 15 hours of being in a process before you get to the point where you can see something. And I think for me, all of the reading I was doing, hundreds of hours of reading, brought me to this moment where I was able to see that human activity is about energy.
Yeah.
That everything we do is about energy. And then I realized, hold it, that's how life works. Life is this fascinating phenomenon of capturing energy and using energy and then releasing energy.
Yeah.
And then you start to feel this entire thing is about the sharing and transfer and having a turn at using some different kinds of energy. Oh my goodness. And when you feel it, it's not just a thought, it's a perspective that a train of thought can maybe bring you to, and then you feel a little bit like riding upward on a roller coaster. You reach that weightless moment where you go over the crest. Oh, that's what this is about.
Yeah. So. Yes, and it is it's like an awareness thing more than an intellectual thought. It's yeah. like it floods over you that this whole thing is not entirely what we've thought it is, yeah. and that there's a playfulness and a yeah. yeah. And this is a beautiful time to talk about setting free, the fourth stage. So we begin by letting go, we move into letting things be, then we let come what may, and that is followed by a setting free, which is, I think, the promise, the gift of looking at this stuff we don't want to look at. And the gift of your book is the setting free feels like a soulful way to live in these times. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about setting free.
I wish I would have included this quote in the book. One of my favorite novelists, Walker Percy, has a character named Will Barrett in a book he wrote called The Last Gentleman. And Will Barrett, and I guess the narrator says something to the effect of, happy is the man who has ruined his life, something like that. And what he means is, when you haven't ruined your life, you have all this pressure to fix it and keep it going and make it better. Mm. And he's saying, when a person reaches a point where they say, I've ruined my life, they think, wow, I have nothing to defend. I have nothing. Everything is possible.
You know? Yeah, yes, yes. Yes, I've often said this about that there's a fearlessness that comes when you get through the worst thing you could possibly have imagined. It's like suddenly you realize, what was I so afraid of? Yeah. The rules that I thought this life was run by, well, the worst case scenario has happened and I'm still here. So I guess everything's possible now.
Yeah. And I suppose that's something I hope people experience in the process of reading or listening to reading this book or listening to this podcast, where we reach a point where we say, oh, you know, there are these four scenarios. None of them are great. Some of them are, from our perspective, way better than others. But I faced it. Okay, I'm alive.
Yeah.
I'm breathing. I get to keep living. How do I want to live? Anything's possible. In light of knowing what I know, my old set of plans and priorities and assumptions are no longer as relevant as I thought they were, but the new options are there. And that freedom is, it's just a remarkable freedom, you know? Mm. It's a you think of the arrogant man who is sort of raised in patriarchy and capitalism, and everything's about money and power and status and, you know, sex and pleasure, and he's got his whole agenda, and you know, everything falls apart for him. And he says, well, that life hasn't gone so well. But now, you know, whether he's 40 or 60 or whatever, he gets to say, I guess I could live a different way.
Yeah.
And there's enormous freedom. And in fact, it's a benefited freedom from the failures. Like, well, that was sure a dead end. Mm. Don't need to do that again. Yes. You know?
And this is one of the weird paradoxes of this world. I've quoted a bit lately Joseph Campbell's line, that the cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek, which is so wonderful on this front. And I think about a neighbor of mine growing up who was always a bit of a reserved man, didn't really say a lot. My dad knew him. I knew his kids, but he got a terminal cancer diagnosis. Mm. And dad still tells me the story of this incredible story of this man who was just a pretty reserved, sort of unemotional, slightly detached human being in a sense, becoming almost like a mystic in the last few months of his life. It was as if he faced the very thing that he thought, I never would want to face that. That would be unbearable. Yeah. That would be impossible. Yeah. And on the other side of it, or through it, came this setting free process. Yeah. Which is the beautiful promise of this. And there are so many wonderful quotes in the setting free part of the book. I can't remember who this quote was, but the line, it is a magnificent thing to be alive in a moment that matters so much. Because there's one way of reading this narrative, which is, why have we all been born in the midst of this time that the climate's falling apart and we're facing such terrible things? But to flip it and go, what a gift to be alive in a moment that matters so much, that is such a meaningful moment. Do you feel that shift has happened in you after the process of the book?
Oh, very much so. Very much so.
Well, you actually do write that there isn't another moment in history you would choose to be alive than this one. Which some people might be surprised to hear. Tell me why you feel that way.
Well, in that section, one of the things I do is I imagine, what if I'd lived at this point in the past, at this point in the past? And there could have been advantages to each of them. But I realize, oh, if I'd lived then, I probably would have valued this that has turned out in history to not be so great. And I suppose then you realize, well, you don't, as Tolkien said in Lord of the Rings, you know, had Gandalf say, you don't get to choose when you're born and when you're alive. You just get to choose how you want to live in the times you were given. And yeah, I have no envy of anyone else, but maybe part of that is because at some point I was converted from thinking a conventional life is the life I wanted. Mm. Or an easy life is the life I wanted. Once you say, I would like a meaningful life, I would like a fruitful life, well, this is a great time for a meaningful and fruitful life.
That is a quote of yours that I think I'm going to put on a poster, Brian, towards the end of the book. You say, true, this isn't a great time for an easy life, but if you want a meaningful life, you showed up right on time. I love that line so much. And you sort of give, all the readers a mission, in a sense, to, in your words, create small circles of beauty everywhere. Mm. That's the response at the moment, or one of the key responses to this situation. And you mentioned your evening around a campfire with a group of other people, and how this sort of approach of creating small circles of beauty can hold us into the goodness of life in quite a profound way. Mm. Tell me about the small circles of beauty that you're noticing in your life at the moment.
Mm. Oh, my goodness. Well, I'll give you an example. I just, as I was driving over here today, I had a podcast on. It's Anderson Cooper, who's a well-known American journalist on CNN, and he was interviewing Stephen Colbert, one of our best comedian, and often comedians, as you know, are moral philosophers. That's those two, I think, go together, and he is that.
I was just at a taping of his show in New York a couple of days ago, as we were talking about it. He's a profound man.
Oh, my Stephen, goodness. Yeah. And Anderson has a podcast about grief, and he interviewed Stephen, and they shared their experiences of grief. And you could feel in this podcast, I hope people feel that about your conversation, our conversation right now, but you could feel that those two men were savoring life together and facing grief together and finding the beauty in the grief. And as I was listening to that, I felt in a certain way they were having this conversation. And now me sitting in my car driving, I was brought into the conversation. And we were together savoring some of the deep beauties of life, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know, I made this box of cards a couple of years ago with prompt questions on it called Private Speaking. And one of the questions on this box that is probably my favorite question in there, actually, is... if you found out that an asteroid was heading towards Earth and we'd all be dead in 6 hours, how would you want to spend your last 6 hours? And I love asking people this question because what happens is all that's unimportant is immediately stripped away. Yeah. Nobody is talking about the taxes or what if we don't have, you know, enough money to pay the mortgage in 6 months' time or whatever it might be, or the drama with their sister or their brother that they haven't looked at. Instead, people are... say they'd head to the beach with their loved ones and play a game, or they'd sit by a river, or they'd, you know, that there's some sense in which, I don't know, there's these small circles of beauty are what we're always being drawn towards. Mm. And in fact, all the other things, the anxiety, the pressure, the worry, the fear, that looming sense of doom, which you explore throughout the book, that's the stuff that once we move through that to the other side, we find the small circles of beauty everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. That's
it. Beautiful. A couple more things to wrap up our conversation. Another quote that you use in the book that I loved, Brian, you quote Robin Wall Kimmerer, who writes, "It is not enough to weep for our lost landscapes. Even a wounded world is feeding us. Even a wounded world holds us, giving us moments of wonder and joy. I choose joy over despair, not because I have my head in the sand, but because joy is what the earth gives me daily, and I must return the gift." Hmm. And that again, it's that small circles of beauty idea.
Oh, yes. And what a gift Robin Wall Kimmerer is, an indigenous person who's trying to bring to the larger flailing civilization wisdom from her her heritage. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is a beautiful one, and reminded me again of this. I think I mentioned the story a couple of times. I took a bunch of the high schoolers where I work to Uluru, to the center of Australia for a retreat in 2023. And having this small circle of humans sharing life together, experiencing awe, wonder, and beauty.
Yeah.
There is something about that where if we are moving towards extinction, and who knows? Who knows how matter and energy will reorganize themselves and what happens next? But if we are, there's something foundationally true about that and those experiences, and that's the North Star to guide us through. And this is where, just about, you end the book. You write, this is where the epiphany begins to sparkle. Our civilization is not the point. Our species is not the point. If we are to exist, we must exist not for ourselves, but for the health of the whole, for the joy of the cosmic dance, the dance of energy, light, and love. And that, Brian, just feels as good a place to end this conversation as possible. The book is Life After Doom. I genuinely think, Brian, this is a book that's going to heal something profoundly troubled in a lot of people. So thank you so much for writing it. I imagine it was not an easy process. How are you feeling on the other side of it? Has it taken a toll?
You know, a lot of my books took a toll simply because I was afraid that, you know, I'll lose some friends, or people will hate it, or people will think it's silly, or whatever. But in each case, you take the risk. You know, and you feel honored that you got to take the risk. Yeah. Mm.
Well, it's been wonderful visiting you here in Florida. I am off to check out some alligators today in a swamp nearby that you've recommended. So I'll have to make another trip back to Florida at some stage for another conversation, Brian. But thank you so much for the book, and thank you so much for joining the podcast.
Thanks for the good work you do. This podcast, I think, can create moments like this for not only your conversation partner, but then the people who are listening all around the world. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Brian. The book is Life After Doom. You can go and pre-order it now, and it'll be out in May.